All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Sterling looking to run for a gap, finds Harry Kane, sets it up for Jack Grealish, then on to Shaw, big chance for England, Sterling is there again! You cannot underplay the magnitude of that goal from England's hero, Raheem Sterling. 10 minutes to go for England to hold on, but they've got a big issue here. And Muller has been sent through the middle of the England defence. Muller wide! Maybe England's luck is in after all. How on earth did Thomas Muller not bury that? Forward, Harry Kane wants it played into him. He chooses Grealish instead. It's Grealish, it's Kane! England have a 2-goal lead! So many questions that there's no better answer than that.
You know what my dad told us to do? He's like, why don't you and Andrew have some like arguments? I was like, what? He's like, about what? He's like, I don't know, anything. I was
just
like,
have a row.
When we do disagree, then we do have a disagreement. He's like, yeah, but just make it up over any old shit people want to say. That I was like, that's fake, man.
I know where he's coming from though. Like, they do on Talksport all the time, don't they? Adrian Dunham and that.
I don't listen to it, man. To be
yeah,
fair.
They do. They like Jim White and Simon Jordan do it as well. They'll almost deliberately bring up points that they know is going to be like, and they'll have like one will have like a really strong side of it, and the other one will deliberately be the antithesis of it. And
well, I imagine we'll have a disagreement today because I'm going to be slagging off Mbappe every chance I get.
So, oh yeah, there's that potential.
Yeah.
All right. So as you've just heard, that is the only thing that we really want to talk about on the podcast this week. We've got an extensive breakdown of England's colossal win against Germany in a knockout game of a major competition, finally. And with player ratings and a look ahead to the game against Ukraine tomorrow. We also have a review of the rest of the round of 16 games, including the Magic Monday games between Croatia versus Spain and France versus Switzerland. And as always, we have the combat sports section delivered as analytically as ever at the back end of the episode. So I'll kick us off with the five things you might have missed. 19-year-old Brit Jack Draper had a baptism of fire in the first round of Wimbledon this week as he was drawn against world number one Novak Djokovic. He received a wildcard entry into this year's tournament and actually took the first set as he bid to make history by overturning the 1-200 Serbian favourite and attempted to pull off what probably would have been the biggest tennis upset of all time. Unfortunately for him, the five-time Wimbledon champion shook off the early rust and won the three sets following the first, only dropping five games in the process. So, fair play to this lad. 1-200, you wouldn't fancy putting £200 onto in a pound, would you?
Well, as soon as you text me, I just told you, just give it time. You're not usurping Djokovic, man. He's not an old man yet. So, fair play to the kid for winning a set, but that's about all you're getting from the champ, isn't it?
And I think it's three British men in the third round for the first time since in the last 22 years. So into the world of sports over in the US, New York Islanders fans faced with what could have been their final moments watching their team in the past its prime Coliseum, decided to throw beer cans onto the ice in a strange show of adoration for their beloved team. So Islanders forward Matthew Barzal acknowledged that it was a little dangerous and he had never seen anything like it before. So the Islanders were just one win away from going to the Stanley Cup final to play the Montreal Canadiens, but the Tampa Bay Lightning took Game 7 as they bid to make it back-to-back titles. So these projectiles were actually being thrown from some really, really high place in this Coliseum. And if it would have not gone on the head, it probably could have... No, I don't even want to put it out there. It might have been fatal, but there is a chance. Like,
well, they full beer cans.
Who knows?
I can't see them wasting beer. I can get behind this gesture if they're empty beer cans. But if they're just wasting beer, then it's just disgusting.
But I mean, the announcer like on NBC was like in disbelief and he couldn't understand how the fans were like doing this to their own team. Like, it kind of makes sense. Like, boo, throw it at the opposition. The opposition yeah. Just won. But again, like throwing like cans and water bottles like at your own players doesn't really make sense. But it looks like Islanders will have to wait at least another year before they have a crack at a Stanley Cup. As they continue their 37-year wait to be crowned champions again. Sorry for mentioning that, Brody.
Well, hockey's a mad game anyway. Like, they're all punching each other up all over the place. It's the only sport I can think of outside of combat sports where that kind of thing is allowed, not encouraged in some situations. So I can't really feel too sorry for the hockey players. They got helmets on, haven't they?
Yeah.
Number three, collegiate players are finally going to get paid. So This is on the back of the news that the NCAA are going to loosen their restrictions on payment for student athletes. Now, South Park got to the heart of this issue with their 2011 episode, Crack Baby Athletic Association, which parodied the slave master dynamic of wealthy institutions massively profiting off the exploits of their athletes while paying them nothing and only providing them with free scholarships and a stage to showcase their talents. I'm not sure if people over here, non-sports fans at least, realise just how popular and profitable college sports are in the US. And last Wednesday, the NCAA bowed to long-standing pressures and will now allow their athletes to strike endorsement deals while enrolled in college and participating in their given sport. Seems like an obvious move, but by waiving Bylaw 12, the NCAA have made one of the most significant advancements in their 115-year history. Better late than never, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's crazy because obviously the amount of money that they make when they go to the pros, but sometimes they're like 23, 24 by this time. They've been playing sort of this sport since they were like 8 or 9 years old. And even the high school has got like, it's really popular. Even the high school sports you'll find on their sort of like national sports channels and stuff like that. Then a lot of people are tuning in, like more so than say the MLS.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's crazy, like to have like a men's professional league, and you get like high school baseball, high school basketball, which you know a lot of people tune into, and then obviously when you get to the college level, they're like absolute athletes by that point. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're grown men,
they're pros, and they're like Zion Williamson was like he was like ready straight to go straight through to the NBA at like 18 years old. So the fact that he hasn't had the opportunity to make money while he's that good. And there's that many eyes on screens and that much money being generated by the schools and stuff like that. So I think this is absolutely spot on.
Well, it's why people like Kobe Bryant just forewent college altogether and just turned pro at 18 because he understood that I'm just going to be losing millions of dollars. And realistically, I mean, I suppose there's a high percentage of athletes who lose a lot of their money. So I suppose it is a good thing to have a college degree, but realistically, it's only costing you money. To be fair, who's going to go through college? They basically just pass them just on their athletic attributes anyway. So they're not actually emerging with life skills. They could go to punditry or something like that if they've still got all their marbles.
I think the only flip side to that is there's only a very small percentage of, you know, especially in the NFL, a very, very small percentage of the college players actually go and enter the NFL draft.
That's a good point.
Them do get picked up in free agency and get lucky and end up, you know, carving out a career for themselves. But there is a very, very small percentage of them that actually go through to the draft. So
that's even more of a reason for them to get paid, isn't it? Just to get a few mil. Just lock it off, get as much financial security as you can, get a house, something like that. Yeah, there's no reason for them not to be getting paid, so I'm glad they've changed it, but they could have done it about 50 years ago.
Yep. Like. Number four, UEFA has scrapped the away goals rule, which has been a mainstay in European competitions since the mid-1960s. So the away goals rule has been criticised by many in recent times, as football fans and pundits alike have brought attention to the fact that home teams are now less likely to play free-flowing attacking football due to the weight that away goals carry. So this will surely mean more extra time, more penalty drama that we have already seen the best of over the past few days in the round of 16 games in the European Championship. So I think we're all on this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can't overlook the effect that playing in the opposition stadium can have, especially if you go to like venues in Turkey or was it Besiktas or like Galatasaray or places like where you know it's like going to be a cauldron. And that does have an effect on how the games play out. But I don't think that's worth the away goal. The away goal is so valuable. Like, for the away goal to count as two home goals, basically, like, you can't even the score. You have to score one more. It doesn't equate. So this is a really sensible move.
I think I read something when I was doing a bit of research on this, that since the 1970s, the percentage of away teams going through in European competitions has rose from like 19% to 30%. So I think that's probably playing a part into like UEFA's kind of thinking behind this, is the fact that they want to make the competitions more even, more fair. And I think the best way to do that is like, yeah, if you're both even after 90 minutes, go to an extra 30, and then if you can't break the deadlock by then, penalties, isn't it?
Fair
enough. That's the best way for it.
It is fair enough.
It's the best way to decide it.
All right, so number five, Mario Barrios keeping it fresh by getting his hair styled in between rounds in his title fight against Javante Tank Davis. I remember when Ricky Hatton fought Juan Lozcano in Manchester just after his loss to Floyd Mayweather Jr. Paulie Malignaggi was on the undercard and he had these long braids that had to have cut between rounds because they were flopping all over the place and impeding his vision. Now, I can understand that. There was a practical reason for him to get his hair dealt with. why on earth some lad poked his hand through the ropes with what looked like my granddad's comb just to tidy Barry ass off while he's in there with one of the most dangerous punchers in the sport. That's so beyond me. If it led to a victory, I'd be like, yeah, fair play. You've got your confidence up. But no, it's just ridiculous, man.
I reckon that's the source of his power, his hair.
Oh, yeah, Samson Barrios. Yeah. Oh, it didn't help him in the end, did it?
I know. We're going to have a chat about that fight a bit later on as well. All right, so that's it for the five things you might have missed. We're going to go straight into the footy chat, and we're going to talk about the review of England's game against Germany. So, penalties in 1996, the ghost goal in 2010, the haunting moments of those games flashed before our eyes as Thomas Muller was bearing down on Jordan Pickford's goal. And then as the ball slid agonisingly past the right-hand post and Muller dropped despairingly to his knees, the whole country jeering at their screens, we thought maybe, just maybe, this will be our time to shine. And with the prospect of having to beat Ukraine and then either Denmark or Czech Republic to cement a place in the final, there is actual solidified optimism that we can win our first ever European Championships. And there must be a reason why everybody's booking up the village in Moseley for the semi-finals and the final. I've literally just gone on 10 minutes ago trying to book a seat. No, you can't get it for love or money. All booked up. Well, is there a bit too much optimism here? Are we kind of like jumping the gun a little bit here?
I actually think that the Ukraine is a really dodgy assignment for the English. Again, they didn't beat the best team in Sweden to go through, but it was a really, really tight game, and they managed to cinch it in like at the 122nd minute or something like that. I think there's a danger in overcoming Germany, like a proper team, even though they're not what they once were. There's a danger of overconfidence here, and I don't want people to be thinking, oh, we're definitely going to ramp it to the front, because Ukraine are a good team. Denmark are scoring goals for fun at the minute, and Czech Republic have got our boy Schnick, who's like absolutely killing it. So I wouldn't be booking any tables from now, unless you're like an absolute football fanatic. So,
what do you think? There's going to be a bit of like an emotional overload after what's happened against Germany, and it's going to be hard to sort of like level the emotions, because the thing that sticks out in my mind is 2016 against Iceland, when Jordan Pickford is in the tunnel, and he would have only been, what, about 21, 22 then. And he was like in the tunnel going, like, come on, boys, come on, like going absolutely mad. Like, and that's what I'm talking about, that sort of like emotional overload, the amygdala hijack or whatever you want to call it. Do you reckon that there's potential for that happening with England? Say if we go 1-0 down, it's like, ah, shit.
Yeah, we're in a proper game.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's danger of that happening already. Do you know what I mean? So this relief, this release of adrenaline. So, oh, we've finally got over the most difficult game. And then if you look at the opposite side of the table, the tournament tree, you see how many like cutthroat teams are still over there. And then you look at our side, it's quite underwhelming. There's definite potential for becoming too casual in our approach, absolutely.
And these teams have got absolutely nothing to lose. The Ukraine, this is only their second knockout European Championship game ever of all time. The first one being from last week. So when they've just beaten Sweden, so they have nothing to lose, man. Their press is going to eat anything up. Anytime that there's an intonation that England are like not playing their best players, that is all the motivation they're going to need. And they're going to stick that up like a newspaper article saying England think we've already won. Ben Pritchard's already booking tables in the village Moseley. They're going to stick that up in the Ukraine dressing room, like, do you know what I mean?
The old Soviet techniques, man. Roll them out. Roll out the printing presses. I'm telling you, this is a dangerous game. And obviously, it's going to coincide with one of our good friends' birthdays. Shout out to Joe Barr. Happy 30th, mate. But I don't... It's just killed the party, wouldn't it? Imagine we're just like 2-0 down playing like shit. Even our talisman Harry Kane can't drag us through the mire. Oh my God. Can we talk about that coverage in a bit?
It will, definitely. So, the game itself wasn't a classic, was it? Classic in terms of like the result and how it's going to be remembered. But in terms of like football being played in the pitch, it wasn't really a classic. I mean, I thought we only looked threatening from set pieces, you know, for the majority of the first half. I thought the Germans started much more aggressively, playing on the front foot. I carved out the better chances in general, apart from that one right at the end where Harry Kane looked like he was walking through treacle. But England stayed resolute. Raheem Sterling continued to be a bright spark in this England team. Looked menacing every time he picked up the ball in midfield and drove the German back line. Still can't get on the back of the English papers, though. Defensively, we got it spot on again. Harry Maguire has added another element at the back with his ability to maraud into that midfield. I thought that was brilliant. And his reading the game was fantastic. Carl Walker's pace in that right of a back three has gotten us out of trouble on many occasions in the past, and so it was on Tuesday evening again after his covering run for the Reichstanger and Goretzka, which definitely would have been a red card had he not covered round. So I think he definitely got us out of jail there. you know, he forced the pressure on Muller when he was going through to take that shot. If he would have had a second extra to think about it, probably would have bagged it in the bottom corner.
A lot of little turning points in this game, like the one you just mentioned with Walker and Rice, and then with Muller getting through on goal. And then with Harry Kane, with his missed opportunity, there are so many of these little flash points. Had they gone the other way, if Harry Kane would have scored, then it would have eased the pressure. Maybe England would have started playing better a little bit earlier. But then if Muller gets through...
I could have
imagined the whole thing capitulating. I mean, I would hope that it wouldn't. Like, I think this England team is quite composed. But I could definitely imagine the whole thing just going to shit immediately. Sorry, Mum.
And I love that... I love that when Sterling gave away the ball, and he was sort of like in just complete like disarray, like he couldn't deal with watching it, and he was literally just, and he fell onto his knees when he seen Muller put it wide. And then I think it was Declan Rice, and it might have been Phillips, just came and like picked him up, put him on his feet. And I thought, you know, that shows you that we've got a really good team spirit there, I think.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And
absolutely.
everyone's sort of backing each other no matter what. But you know, I think England persevered in that game, and Southgate stuck to his guns. Slight tweaks in personnel, but not in shape. And I think that was absolutely the right move. And although we didn't create an array of chances in the game as a whole, we were clinical when we needed to be. And the Germans weren't. So that was the big difference. You know, obviously we have Timo Werner with that one in the first half. Then you got the Muller one in the second half.
Well, we were saying during the game, I can't believe you started Werner up front. There's absolutely no danger of that kid scoring. I didn't feel threatened once. I was like, no way. His danger lies in him breaking between the lines and bringing other players into play and them scoring goals. He got through on goal like a handful of times, and I did not break a sweat at all. It's a shame for him, really. But
and Pickford didn't either, really, did he? To be fair to him, you know. So, I mean, I think second half entrance of Jack Grealish into the fray was the correct substitution. I mean, I think most people in the country would agree with that.
Oh, Jack.
He added a much needed injection of belief, desire, creativity that gave the whole team the boost they needed. And then in the opposite dugout, Jurgen Loeb, he brought on Serge Gnabry for Timo Werner, which was probably the right sub at the time. You know, same time as Grealish came on for Saka, I thought Saka was unlucky to come off. And then only 5 minutes later, England were on the score sheet through a brilliantly worked Raheem Sterling goal. So, and then, you know, their manager, Joachim Löw, didn't twist. He waited until after the second goal to make a significant move, bringing on Sane and Emre Can.
Yeah, game changer Can. Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you've got like Kevin Volland and Ilkay Gundogan on the bench.
That's a shocker for me, because Gundogan, he's been like, we were talking of him in terms of like replacing Aguero in terms of his prolificacy in front of goal earlier in the season.
He could have played instead of Timo Werner. Yeah. To be honest, he could have played as a false nine and he would have done just as good as a job, if not better. You know what I mean? You'd fancy him to probably put one of those away, that one of those chances that Germany had. You'd fancy Gundogan, the way he's been playing this season, to put one of those away. But
puzzling.
Very puzzling. And, you know, I'm sure in years to come, the exiting German coach's tenure with the national team will be looked on with fondness and admiration for what he's achieved in the past. You know, with a World Cup win and European Championships runners-up medal. That's, you know, it's not bad. You know, there's not many sort of international managers that have those accolades to put to their name. But, you know, I think, however, after that, you know, the ignominy of failing to get out of the group stage at the 2018 World Cup, and now failing to beat England in that last 16 tie, I think it all left a sour taste in the mouth of the Mannschaft faithful, and rightfully so, as the last two competitions must be seen as a gross underperformance given the history of the team and the personnel he had at his disposal. I'd say Germany, not quite in crisis, but they're certainly in an uncomfortable period of transition, a bit like England were, you know what I mean, say 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, England, on the other hand, have relieved of their growing pains, and now they're surely looking at a golden age under Southgate, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think the period of transition is far more pronounced with Germany because they've been so much better than England over the past few decades. I mean, you really can't deny that. We England fans cling on to that 5-1 win, do you know what I mean? Which was like 20-odd years ago.
Yeah, 2001, yeah.
You can't really speak of any significant wins in tournament football against the Germans in any time since... I can't even think.
Since 1966, we haven't beat them in a knockout stage because they beat us in 1996 in the semi-final European Championships. They beat us in 2010, which was the quarterfinals of the World Cup. We did beat them in a group stage of the 2000 European Championships. I think
1-0.
Yeah. And then obviously we beat them in that game that you just alluded to there, 2001.
I think that was a qualifier. So that it's slim pickings for England. Yeah, when a Heskey gets on the score sheet, you're in trouble, man.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the players they've got. It's not going to be too tough of a transition either. Mm. Once they switch a few things, it's like having a club manager. They've got the players, they've got the assets, they've got the infrastructure. They just need to mix things up. He's been at the helm a long time now. So, as you say, World Cup winner, European Championship runner-up, fair play to him. Absolutely outstanding coach, but just it's come to an end.
Yeah, it's just tight. It's just sometimes those, you know, those periods in management, there's always going to need to be a sort of finale to it, and it's just about time that he did step aside. It's a shame that he's had to do it on the back of two kind of like, you know, exits that you wouldn't expect from Germany, but I'm sure after sort of like a few months when the dust has settled, like German fans will look back on him and just say, like, yeah, he was one of our great managers. All right, so we'll go through the player ratings and we can sort of like knock this back and forth and see what we think. Obviously, there's been, you know, I've looked at loads of different people that have had their say in player ratings, but, you know, I've kind of tried to look at it, you know, from as sort of like objectively as possible. I think Jordan Pickford, tell me if you disagree with this, but I think he's possibly been England's most important player so far this Euros, with the exception of Raheem Sterling. I mean, he made two big saves to deny Timo Werner in the first half, and then that Havertz one in the second, where he had to tip it over, you know, like really like reaction save, had to tip it over the bar. I think he's commanded the area, distribution of the ball, and his reliance as England's stopper have exceeded all my wildest expectations. And like don't forget, he wasn't in our original sort of England teams for us to start. We were thinking about, you know, maybe you should go with Dean Henderson from United, just because of the sort of unreliability that he's had as a keeper in this past, say, 18 months in terms of his play for Everton. And, you know, I don't think he's played as well as he has over the last sort of four games, but fair play to Southgate, he's got that one spot on. I'll give him an 8.
Well, I think he's a proper keeper for sure. Because I don't watch that much club football throughout the season, I really didn't have any expectations of him. I wasn't gutted when, you know, the whole keeper setup was changed. I had no expectations. I just hope for the best, really. Who did he save from where it hit the inside of his thigh? Was that from Werner?
Yeah, the one in the first half.
Oh my God, yeah. That was like, it was one of those, again, one of those
defying
flash
moments.
Yeah, and I know there was an element of luck there, but you got to get down there, don't you? And I think with the Havertz one, that looked a little bit more spectacular than it actually was. Yeah, great reaction save and all that, but
if he doesn't save it.
Yeah, but as my boy Roy Keane would say, he's doing his job, he's got gloves on, do you know what I mean? So it's, but yeah, absolutely agree. It's not only that he's making these saves, that he's a presence. When it goes through to the final third, you're not thinking, oh my God, he's going to make a mad mistake. I don't want to jinx him now against Ukraine, do you know what I mean? But so far, so good. Can't disagree with an 8.
Nah, solid. He hasn't put a foot wrong in the whole tournament. Kieran Trippier, another solid, reliable performance from the versatile defender. I give him a 7. Southgate relies on him with his experience and calls him his warrior. Can see why he places so much faith in him. A threat from set pieces with his deliveries, both from sort of free kicks and I think the odd corner. So I don't think you can deny with that one. 7.
Well, I think you've gone down a point, haven't you, since we were talking about it on the day. I remember you saying blanket 8s across the back, the back 5 really, wasn't it, at times?
No, it's probably just that, like, you know, that slid the adrenaline in me, didn't I? Yeah.
What made you reconsider? Did he, on reflection, did he let you down? Disappointing in certain aspects? Or?
Obviously, I haven't watched the full game back, but I've tried to, like, it's hard to watch the full game back. I don't know where you can watch full games nowadays.
It's copyrighted up, isn't it?
No, yeah, so, but I've watched the sort of the extensive highlights a few times. Just not as involved as some of the other players, and I think if you can ever give certain players 8, you can't really give other players 7s. You have to sort of like mix it around a little bit.
Yeah, that's fair.
Do you know what I mean? So, as you see a few ones in the later ones, obviously Kyle Walker, I'll give him a 7 as well. I think his pace at the back saved a certain goal. I think if we were going to give 0.5s, probably give him a 7.5. You know, saved a certain red card for Declan Rice. He got tangled up with Leon Goretzka. So he was part of the two big German moments, Kyle Walker was. So I definitely think, actually, we need to probably bump him up a little bit.
I was just about to say, based on the evidence you've given, I think if Trippier's a 7, he's got to be an 8, really.
Yeah. So either he goes down to a 6 or he goes down to up to a 7.5. So, I mean, put pressure on that Thomas Muller when he had that chance. He makes the tactical switch from right back to right side his centre back look so easily. I don't know if that's because he's been part of the Man City setup under Guardiola for so long. But like, he does it a lot more naturally than most players would.
It's not too drastic of a transition, though, is it, really? If you're playing in a 3, you are going to be pushed over to that side a little bit more. So,
but I think only there's, you know, there's only a certain crop of elite footballers that probably would be able to do it. Like, because a lot of players will get found out. Obviously, his pace helps him out. but it's always his attributes being able to play in both of those positions. So like, you wouldn't be able to play Harry Maguire at left wing back or right wing back,
for example,
or John Stones. Yeah. So for him to make that sort of seamless kind of transition, I think fair play to Kieran Trippier as well. You know, he's played on the left side, the left wing back side as well, and the right wing back side. So he's quite a versatile player, and I think that's probably why he went with... You know, we were taking the piss a few weeks ago about the sort of four wing-backs before Trent couldn't come.
It's actually turned out wicked, hasn't it, really?
And he has. To be fair to Southgate, he's genuinely got it.
He's got his badges. He knows what he's talking about.
You know what I mean? He's got his pro licence, man. So fair play to him. So John Stones, going to give him a 7 as well. So most of that back line, I think solid performances. You have to. You know, clean sheet against the Germans. Haven't considered a goal yet. Another commanding performance from the Man City man. Showing he looked comfortable as part of a back three as well as a centre-back pairing, made the wrong decision putting pressure on the ball, leading up to the Muller chance, which if you watch that on back, you know, he was left one-on-one, isolated after that sort of Raheem Sterling. I think he was trying to play the pass back, but he got caught in possession.
He could, you know, if that was going the other direction, that would be a Pogba-esque pass, wouldn't it? It was perfect the way it went to Muller, do you know what I mean? It was so unfortunate, but yeah, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, because I think Havertz nicked it. I think there was a pressure on him, man. I think he was sort of forced into a pass, but it went short, and then Havertz played him in.
But what
John Stones did, he went to put pressure on Havertz initially, which was the wrong decision. Actually, he should have just backed off and tracked the runner. He didn't need to pressure because he was one-on-one.
It's in the moment, though, isn't it, man? It's tough.
You know, that could have been costly. That could have cost us the game, really. Yeah. So that's why I can't give John Stones an 8.
That's fair enough. And obviously overshadowed next to an absolutely towering Harry Maguire, Slavhead himself. I mean, I was astounded by his performance. The way he's carrying the ball through. He's beating like 2-3 players at a time. Do you know what I mean?
Upgraded to captain, Slavhead. Gotta be, man. Gotta. Come on. I mean, I thought he was brilliant. Like, he looked sharp, carried the ball into midfield with poise. Comfortable high pressing on the German midfield, not allowing them to turn and play forward. Once again, nearly got caught out early, I'm pretty sure, with his position, and I haven't been able to re-watch it. But by what I remember of it, is his position was really, really high on the one where Declan Rice had to cover for him. Yeah. Hence why I think Declan Rice was tracking back Leon Goretzka when that ball came over. I think he sort of pressed high, and I think he got caught by whoever was playing that sort of 1-2, the wall pass. And I think he probably decided that he wasn't going to sort of, you know, try and press him as high as that for the rest of the half. Although there was instances where he was kind of pressing almost in the attacking third, Harry Maguire. He was really high on the press sometimes. But I think having three centre-backs and having really versatile players in the wing-back areas, that kind of gave us that sort of like tactical rotation, that tactical shift. Because fair play to Kyle Walker as well. He was going on like underlaps and overlaps, man.
But you know, also it gives England the penetration they needed at times. You know, when the defensive line doesn't sit super deep, but it sits deep enough that it's really hard to get things going whilst the game's static. And while he was pushing up high, it made things happen. This is the main difference between this performance and the previous performances for the England team for me is that there were more players willing to take these kind of chances. And obviously, they nearly backfired in certain occasions. But this was you do have to be adventurous. You do have to be a little bit daring in his games. And it did, thankfully, pay off.
Yeah, so Harry Maguire, 8. Another player that I gave an 8, which I thought... You know, I've seen ratings of a 6 for Luke Shaw, which had me in absolute disbelief because he played a huge part in both of our goals. You know, and was a major factor as to why we nullified the German threat in wide areas. Obviously, you know, he had the cross through to Raheem Sterling, which was a like perfectly weighted pass to Sterling so he could just tap it in. And then he's the one that stepped up and won the ball prior to the just ahead of the second goal. And then I think he passed it to whoever that would have been, Kane Grealish, and then. Grealish was out wide, wasn't he? So yeah, I think he probably fed it into Kane. Kane maybe fed it out to, or there's a Sterling in there or something like that. So
pivotal role, anyway.
Because definitely,
he was solid the whole time, and he's like, I've said it loads of times. I can't believe he's only 25. I can't believe it, which is a great sign for England in the future because he's not quite as fast as Kyle Walker, but he's quick enough.
He's pretty rapid for a guy that he looks chubby for me as well. He doesn't look kind of like a sort of natural athlete. He looks like he has to work really hard in the gym. I'm not sure what's down to. Much just down to his, you know, sort of his genetics, really. But he's super quick, man. Like, really, really quick. And I think good going forward. Obviously, we've seen him for United as well. He can score a good goal as well. So I think it's hard to see how he doesn't start against Ukraine. I think that was a great performance from him.
It's hard to anticipate what Southgate's going to do next with this lineup, because I think Joe Barr made the point that it may be an oversimplification, but the England team on the night did actually mirror Germany's formation, what they were trying to do as well. So I don't know if Southgate was started off from a negative perspective in terms of, I just want to stop them doing what they're doing and then just build on it from there. I don't want to see many of these players get left out against Ukraine, you know. I don't really want to see it because of how well they performed in it. But one player, as you're about to say now, Calvin Phillips, who started off the tournament really well, maybe because of the role he was given, maybe because the instructions, not quite as impactful as we've seen him.
Potentially, could he be given that sort of role, the role he was given in that first game against Croatia, where he looked so devastating, you know, his energy, his tenacity, you know, just getting in between the lines, you know, playing with confidence, pressing from the front. Do you reckon we could probably go revert back to that?
The whole strength of England for this tournament has been their defensive stability. Now, you will sacrifice some of that if you give up one of your defensive midfielders. And I'm not sure I'd want him to give up any of that, because I'd rather him nick a goal in a terrible game than give away two sloppy goals. Do you know what I mean?
But there's always chance, you know, of conceding from a set piece. And we just have, we've been playing sailing so far. You know, I'm not saying that we haven't defended well, but there's been big moments in games that have kind of gone our way. You know,
especially against Germany.
Against Germany. So I think him, Calvin Phillips and Declan Rice, I think I'll give them both sixes. You know, I think Calvin Phillips didn't get away with as many fouls as he has done in previous games and picked up a booking. So he was kind of less likely to be sort of like pressing from the front and being really aggressive. So obviously you can see the Bielsa force is strong with him. And then Declan Rice, I think, you know, he was treading on thin ice as well. So both of those players, both of the centre mids, the holding players, picking up bookings. But I think Declan Rice navigated through the rest of the game well. Once again, screens the back three really well, goes about his business, you know, doesn't make any fuss, but he's always there. And he was like, you know, proper like cramps at the end, you know, could barely walk kind of thing. So
I think he was incredibly disciplined to navigate the rest of that game without picking up another yellow, because at times it was like, there were a lot of 50-50s in that game where in other games you've seen a yellow or a red. And the more I talk about this, the more fortunate I think England were in that respect. To have your two holding midfielders on yellows. And then we were saying
fairly
it.
Fairly early on, I think. Because I think Royce, was like the third minute, wasn't it?
It was one of the first things that happened in the game.
And then I want to say Calvin Phillips was about 20th minute or something.
It was before, both of them were on yellows before the first half ended.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, fair play to both of them. And maybe that extra caution, maybe that kind of switched them on a little bit more. Maybe they didn't go in a little bit aggressively where they otherwise they might have. But I can't disagree with your assessments there. But I thought Declan Rice was actually, like, did a good job of covering where there were those holes poking him. Especially when Maguire went forward, you'd see him slotting straight away. Yeah. Really disciplined there. So.
Yeah. So, so Bukayo Saka, give him a 7. Became only the third teenager to start in a knockout match for England. Do you know who the other two are?
Rooney and Owen?
Yeah.
Woo!
Bang on. Fire.
Unbelievable.
Another bright performance from the young man who didn't let the big occasion phase him whatsoever. Could be considered unlucky to be the guy that made way for Jack Grealish, but that substitution did change the game.
It did indeed. And what other change could he have made to bring Grealish on? I mean, I know what I would have done, but what happened later in the game might contradict that. What? Who else would you have changed him for, right, other than Saka?
Had to be Kane.
Had to be Kane, didn't it? But let's not kick him too hard just yet. Let's go to the imperious Raheem Sterling.
Let's talk about the actual talisman, man. You know, the new age talisman. Man of the match performance. Like, you know, basically again for England. It's baffling how the newspapers were showing Harry Kane and not this guy to me. We talk about that term talisman just because we were all creasing when that commentator came out of it.
Couldn't believe it, man. It's like, this ain't Pokemon, mate.
To say Harry Kane. And like, he's been bandied around quite a bit lately. But for me, Sterling has consistently earned his right to be considered England's best player of this tournament. Constant threat every time he ran at the German defenders. Like, they were petrified to get close to him, man, just in case they, you know, they committed a foul. He had a great running shot in the first half that tested Manuel Neuer. Did brilliantly for the goal, showing great composure in the box, which has been one of the facets of his game that's been criticised in the past. And then he showed real intelligence to just check his run prior to that Luke Shaw cross and just bend it back slightly. Just like really, really great attacking player. like, if he gets his first touchdown, which I'd say is one of the bad parts of his game, like, the only real sort of, like, one for improving, should we be considering, like, this guy world-class?
I always thought he was considered world-class. Look at what he did at Liverpool. Look at what he's done at City.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really see an argument against it, to be honest. Like you say, when he's bombing forward and he can change direction so quickly, dribbling with the ball, arms flapping everywhere, you know, and now that if he's adding, not adding, he's scored a lot of goals in his career, man. He's not playing for the centre, he's creating attacking opportunities for other people. I don't really see how people are saying he's not world class.
I've seen that criticism, like, yeah, he's a pretty good fair, but I don't like the way he runs.
Yeah, it is annoying though.
It's like,
it's annoying.
No one cares, like literally, like, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't
make him any better or worse for a footballer, does it? Like,
but, yeah, I don't see. Or I can't imagine a fair criticism of him for not slotting into any of the best teams in Europe. I really can't. Moment.
And there was talk of Man City offering 100 million for Harry Kane plus Raheem Sterling. He's 26 years old. He's never scored in an international competition before. Now he's got 3 goals. Potentially could get more. Well, definitely I think we'll get more. He's won Premier League titles with Man City. He scored, like, consistently scored, like, with 15-plus goals a season. Oh, so he hasn't had a great, great season this year. And we were talking about him at the start, like, not about leaving him at home, but should he be a starter? All right, he's proved that he should be a starter. Like, Southgate put his faith in him. And then you talk about Harry Kane, who gets a start no matter what, because he's quite clear, and he didn't want to get taken off the pitch. And, like, now, I'll give him a 5, and you actually think that might be a bit generous.
I think that's very generous. I'll be as fair as possible here. He headed in the second goal, but my nan could have scored that goal.
It was placed right in his noggin.
I could have scored that goal. I think my nan's got a better chance than me of scoring that goal, to be fair. But Harry Kane did nothing. Every touch went awry. He was behind the pace the whole game. It was as if he'd forgotten how to play football. And it's not through lack of effort. Do you know what I mean? You could see he was trying. You could see he was trying to get involved in the game. You could see he was running his ass off. But there's just something not right there. I don't see how you can... maybe the 5 is because of the goal.
I think it was... I was seeing the Daily Mail give him 7.5.
That's outrageous.
That is outrageous, isn't it?
How can you...
I would say an 8. An 8 or a 9 is man of the match performance. Because obviously you're not going to give anyone a 10 unless they score like a hat-trick and they're absolutely amazing. So 8 or 9 would be a man of the match performance. So 7.5 is just below a man of the match performance. Are you are you having a laugh?
I think it speaks volumes about the whole situation and his performance. When he went down in like the 70-something minute and we're all going, get him off! This is it! Get him off! This is the moment you've been looking for, Southgate, get him off! And it was just fine. Everyone was like, oh my God, I can't.
Yeah, we were talking about, you know, perhaps even Southgate said to him, like, you know, you're having a shocker.
Yeah.
Like, if you're still having a shocker after 10 minutes, just go down, say you're a bit, you're feeling a bit sore.
Then it happened.
And then it happened, and then he just got up and got on with it, unfortunately.
I would give him a 3, a generous 3. Can you think of anything else, seriously, anything else in that game other than a goal that he did that contributed to the performance?
Nah.
I can't.
I've written down there, like, you could argue he only had 5 good touches in the whole game, one of them being the goal. And I think his reputation kept him on the field, man.
Yeah.
His reputation kept him on the field. At that 60-minute, or I think it was 70-minute mark when Saka came off of Grealish, like, his reputation kept him there. You know what I mean?
And
the big name player mentality kept him on the field.
Well, let's not forget the absolute sitter that he missed early. Was it in the first half?
Yeah,
he got through. And I was giving him benefit of the doubt during the game, where I said, was it Kimmich who got back and got in like a pretty good tackle, man? But Tommy Howes said, shout out to Tommy Howes, he said, like, the poor touch enabled the defender to come back and recover that.
Yeah, it was a shocking touch.
Horrendous.
Like, 2 yards away from him. Like, you wouldn't think a world-class striker of his calibre, like, how much we know and how good he can be. Like, he looks a shadow of what he's been like in the last sort of, like, the sort of 2-3 months ago at the end of the Premier League season. I can't remember exactly, like, how well he was playing, but the way we know Kane can play, we haven't seen that in the past 4 games.
I think his valuation must have been dropping like a million a minute during that game.
You know what I mean? Like Bitcoin.
Yeah, plummeting. Yeah. But, you know, his agent must be pulling his hair out, man. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to Like you say,
I don't want to dig him out too much.
He's got a good reputation for a reason. I'm not saying he's a bad player. I'm saying he had a shocker of a game. That's what I'm saying.
And he's, you know, he seems like a top bloke. He seems like a great asset to that change room. But like, if that was Raheem Sterling that had had that level, that caliber game, honestly,
I'll tell you.
Can you imagine the papers?
Well, just quickly before we move on, because I don't want to spend too much time on this. But why is it that Harry Kane is getting so much love and Raheem Sterling is just like... Because I don't want to reduce the issue just to race. Because that's an easy one.
But we all know it is, though, isn't it?
But that's the low-hanging fruit. But, like, anyone with eyes could see how bad of a game Harry Kane had. Raheem Sterling's been performing consistently throughout the tournament. So what is that about? It can't just be race. It can't be, man. There's this weird narrative that they're pushing. I'm not sure why, but what's going on, man?
I think you were saying only one of the 12 tabloid newspapers in the United Kingdom had Raheem Sterling on the back. The rest of them had Kane.
And, yeah, and it was The Sun that had him on the back as well.
Which is crazy to think out of all the papers, though.
So, maybe it's a bit of a broad question, but I'd like to give some thought to that because in a thinking person's world, there's no reason that should be happening.
From a sporting perspective, it made absolutely zero sense. I mean, like, Kane's 45 minutes is about as bad as I've ever seen from him. But he still turned up with the goal when he needed it. And I know, let's give him some credit for that, because great strikers, they do hit bad patches and they're still there in the right place
That's
for the
fair.
Goal,
that
which
is,
he was.
That is fair.
So, of course, he'll start against Ukraine on Saturday. I'd be gobsmacked if he doesn't. But what if he has another poor 60, 70 minutes against Ukraine and then he's got other lads at his disposal? He's got Rashford that hasn't had a shout. He's got Jadon Sancho that hasn't had a shout. Dominic Calvert-Lewin wasn't even on the bench. He can't get on and get minutes. What happens? Does he try? Does he stick or does he twist?
Listen, I don't want Kane to have another bad performance. I want him to be the player he is, but he's in a bit of a slump at the minute. I think he'll do the same thing. I think
I can't see him flipping a switch and turning it on, can you? No. Because he looks so far off the pace.
Yeah.
And so I don't even want to say lack of desire because I know that's not it. I just think he is absolutely mentally and physically exhausted, man. From the long season that, you know, he's been playing at this high level for Tottenham now for what, like 6-7 seasons on the trot, barely having a week off rest. You know, Europa League, Champions League, basically playing every game and then playing for England as well. He just looks absolutely, for a better of a term word, bollocks.
Yeah, fatigue will get everyone in the end. I suppose Ronaldo and Messi, they're kind of like in another realm, aren't they? They're psychos. So they eat the right food, they don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't party, they don't, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. They don't do anything but think about football.
Yeah,
I think
an unrealistic expectation to have of 90% of professional players. So maybe he's just got a life and maybe it's not akin to burning the candle at both ends, but it's just become too much for him. Maybe he just needs like a month in the sun, just doing nothing, doing a bit of yoga or something, do you know what I mean? Just chilling out, I don't know.
So all right, let's just have a quick word on Grealish and then we'll wrap this up. Changed the game, coming onto the field. I don't think he physically actually, obviously he had a part to play in the goal, so he did change the game, but the game changed with his presence coming onto the field. I think he gave a lift. It seems so ironic because he's only played, what, like a handful of games, 8 games maybe. But his presence just seemed to like reinvigorate everyone on the field, reinvigorated the crowd. And there was just like kind of this, I don't know, it was just because Piers was going absolutely barmy when he was coming on because he's a Villa fan. But he did have that feeling that he was really like boosting the whole scenario.
Yeah, for sure. And like, not only does it lift the fans and their support, but look, the rest of the players on the England team, they know how good Grealish is and they know what he brings to the team. So they must have been like,
even Saka was saying like, he's wicked to play with in training. Like, it's a pleasure to play with him and shit.
So it doesn't surprise me that he invigorated, rejuvenated, energise the team. And look, these aren't just empty buzzwords I'm using. We scored 2 goals as soon as he came on.
Yeah,
to be fair. The results straight away. I think that extra point.
He was on the pitch for 20 minutes and we scored 2. Yeah. He was involved with one and he got the assist for the other. Obviously placing the ball on Fat Harry's head for the goal.
He's fat. I don't care what anyone says. Harry Kane is carrying at least an extra half a stone. I don't know if he's like, you know, crying into the buffet or whatever.
Does he start against Ukraine?
Of course he does. Oh, Grealish, you mean? I thought you meant
Kane. Because Flynn's saying, you know, he's working as a super sub. Why not just keep it there? But I hate that. I hate the idea of super subs. You've got to play your best players, man. You have to play your best players from the start. Okay, I think he has to be considered one of our better players.
Who did you start ahead of, though?
Saka. I'd say so. It'd be unfortunate, but like I'd say Grealish has earned that more than Saka has.
Yeah, I'd say so. But you know, you lose that kind of that dynamism that Saka brings, and because I think he exhausts defenders.
Yeah, with his constant flexing. Get that from Sterling, though. We get that sort of like real directness, and sort of like Sterling will just dribble at anybody, man, and he'll get past anyone just with his pace and with his technique, with, you know, dribbling and sort of like really putting the defense on the back foot. I think Grealish brings a different element because he'll pop up in places where, you know, defenders don't want to go. They don't want to be dragged into those sort of...
And he does, man. He drags
pop
defenders
up everywhere, and he'll run you silly. And, like, he's got such great strength. He's got such, like, a good core and a low centre of gravity, you know, great balance and poise. And he'll add a different element, man. I think you got Stern on one side, you got Grealish on the other side. We'll play Fat Harry if Southgate wants. and then you got your midfield three, maybe bring Mason Mount back into it. And then, you know, if you want to play Hendo and Rice, something like that, I think that would work. That wouldn't be playing a weakened side. I think that would be actually a positive move.
I think keep Mount out of it, man. I think COVID's the best thing that could have happened. Not so happy Gilmore sorted us out, man. I'm telling you, that prolonged exposure to COVID has been an absolute blessing to the team. I don't think you should come back into the team. I think that's a fair switch you've just said, and your reasons for it are absolutely valid. Like it's a like for like substitution would be Sterling and Saka, wouldn't it? So yeah, Grealish for Saka starting. I think that's fair.
I think if we're giving 0.5s, let's just give Southgate a rating. I'll put a 7, but he's got to be a 7.5. And just by our conversation, now we're actually talking about games. First time about, you know, a prolonged chat about the game. I think tactically got it spot on. We spoke about, you know, prior to the game, we said like there's a good chance that he might go for it at the back, and I think that's a system, you know, that's the way to go, sort of match Germany up, really sort of nullify their attacking flair in the wide areas with Gosens and Kimmich. Hungary, they played that way, I think, in their 2-2 draw in the previous game. Obviously, as we just said, nullified those wing backs. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Southgate reverted back to a back four against Ukraine. Slightly more attacking after they had a grueling 120 minutes against Sweden. I'm not sure how much physical and mental toil, and we spoke about that will have on sort of Sweden. On Ukraine, because we spoke about the extra 30 minutes. But they're professional footballers at the end of the day, you know, and they've got Thursday, Friday to rest.
Yeah, you think that, don't you? But look what's happened to Kane. You don't, I'm not familiar enough with the Ukraine squad to know how many games they've played this season.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I think fatigue is a definite, like a real factor in this
yeah,
time.
Yeah, especially in tournament football. I think Southgate's shown himself to be more of a, you know, we said he seemed like a great man manager. He's a sort of coach that knows which players to sort of give a kick up the arse and which players that he needs to be a shoulder to lean on, kind of thing. But now he's turned out that he is looking a little bit more tactically astute. And although he hasn't got any kind of success as a coach, and we've notified that in the past, you know, with sort of like finishing bottom of like Europe, England when he was at U21 championships, finishing bottom of the group stage, and you know, no success really at club level, but he's showing that he has got some sort of, you know, got some tricks up his sleeve.
Well, I've been thinking he's been way too conservative for my liking. But obviously, I don't know anything about football. And it's the foundations that he's built with his conservative approach have paid dividends in a really important game.
Absolutely.
So it's hard for me to criticise him for being conservative when conservation or patience and composure are very closely aligned. And composure is what you need to win tournament football. So I'm happy. I seen a little quote from him saying, "If I pick that team and we lose, I'm gone." So that's a different kind of daring, a little bit type of like, you know, that's kind of risky to go out knowing that people are going to hate your starting lineup, but thinking it's the right choice. And you can't really say anything bad about him at all. I'd probably give him an 8 as well, to be honest.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think it's amazing what 90 minutes of international football between two teams that have like got such a history like England and Germany have, what it does to a coach's career, man.
Yeah.
It can absolutely tarnish you for almost the rest of your playing career. Like, I think it will with Joachim Löw. I think he will be, in a way, he'll always have that kind of like against him now with those sort of like not getting out of the World Cup. And
what's that, Steve McLaren when they lost to
Wally with the Broly?
Yeah,
that was Germany.
No, it weren't. It was, I think it was like Croatia or something. Like, because it was like 3-2.
Wally was the Broly, which won, we lost the qualifier at home to Germany 1-0. I think Dietmar Hamann scored. That was Wally with the Broly, but he might have been, I'm not sure if he was sacked after that game.
But anyway, point being, he had a disastrous campaign and he just had to like seek refuge in Holland for a couple of years. And like some kind of refugee.
And then he got some
man.
Strange accent. Like.
Yeah, oh, yeah. But yeah, so take your point completely, man.
Right, so just have a quick preview of the England versus Ukraine game coming up tomorrow. So obviously Ukraine going to the game, massive underdogs, with it only being their second knockout game in the history of the European Championships, with the first one being that round of 16 game against Sweden. Looking very likely Ukraine will be set up in a 4-1-4-1. Alexander Zinchenko in the central position being a threat with his wand of a left foot, something that fellow Man City defender John Stones would be aware of. I think coach Andrei Shevchenko is actually utilising him a lot more centrally than he would do at Man City. I think he's used him in a lot of different positions so far this tournament already. So obviously I think he's going to think that he's going to have more impact of a game centrally rather than playing the left wing-back position. But I think he did play there against Sweden, you know, I think he was on that left-hand side, wasn't he? By what you can remember. If
now, you know what I was just about to say, is that Ukraine are probably the team remaining in the tournament that I've watched at least of. They seem to be, I wouldn't have expected them to get through, basically. And apart from the few names you've mentioned there, I don't really know anyone in their team. And I think they were very, very fortunate and were hardworking and determined and all that. But what's his name? Was it Forsberg?
Emil Forsberg hit
the post like two or three times.
Yeah, and he got four goals this tournament as well. Yeah. So like he's really cemented himself as kind of like a really good player in European football. And I think he'll probably get picked up by some, I think he's at Red Bull Leipzig. So, you know, Ukraine, obviously, they only won one game. They beat North Macedonia in that game. So
my favourites from the group stage.
Yeah, so they lost to Netherlands 3-2. And they also lost Austria, I think 1-0 or 2-1 or something. It was a close game, I think. Obviously, they've got another threat to the English back line will be West Ham starlet Andrei Yarmolenko, who will most probably lead the line with striker Roman Yaremchuk, or is more of a wide player, depending on the system that Shevchenko opts to go with. Obviously, they were one of the worst best-placed thirds, you know, if that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, lovely concept, isn't it? Just to make it more complicated.
Yeah. So, they had a valiant comeback against Netherlands. They were 2-0 down, drew level to 2-2. There was a great strike from Yarmolenko in that game. And then there was another good goal from Denzel Dumfries, who's definitely been one of the players of the tournament for me in that right-back position, even though he got knocked out in the round of 16 game. But I think Ukraine will have built confidence. You know, they beat the team that topped the group that included Spain. So, you know, but it's hard to make a case, like a legitimate case, for them to cause England too many problems. But you never know, man. You can't be overconfident.
Yeah, that's the kind of mindset I'm really guarding against. Because as soon as you roll into this game thinking, oh, it's only Ukraine, and you start to list statistics and say, oh, they were one of the worst third-place finishers and all that.
I can see us going 1-0 down, you know. I don't know why. I've got a funny feeling that we'll go 1-0 down quite early on. And then potentially I think we'll bring it back second half. But you never know. The same what would happen with Iceland, I think we went 1-0 up against Iceland, didn't we? And then we ended up losing 2-1 or something.
That Iceland game is burned into your brain, hasn't it?
Well,
I think
you
mentioned it once a week.
At least, man. Yeah, that was disgusting. That was like, that was the worst. One of the worst moments to be an England fan, that was. Because that was like, we absolutely had to beat Iceland. We were like, you know, I was going to France the week after as well, in Paris, to watch England versus France. So, never ever book tickets at the Village. Before you know,
Ben,
you're definitely going to be there, you know what I mean? Because I've already done that in the past, and I got burnt.
I'm not booking tickets anyway, man. I believe in the jinx. I don't want to, even though I curse players every week on this podcast. But,
all right, so that'll be it really for the preview for the England game. We're gonna just have a brief overview of the other last 16 games, which is a bit of a shame, really, because we could talk like extensively over some of these games for like another half an hour at least. But you know, we're sort of going to do an overview of those and look ahead to the quarters. So take us away with some of the games, Jim, that you watched.
Yeah, so Wales go out with a whimper, receiving another red card en route to a 4-0 loss to Denmark. The Welsh were unorganised, with Bale and Ramsey ultimately underperforming, while the Danes continued the free-scoring form that granted them unlikely qualification from the group stages. The Czech Republic impressed with a 2-0 win over 10-man Netherlands. Where was the free-scoring team that bossed the group stage? Dutch defender Matthijs de Ligt received a red card in the 55th minute. In the 68th, Holes put the Czechs ahead, and the impressive Patrick Schick sealed their progression in the 80th. This was one of the major upsets of the round of 16 for me.
Yeah, definitely has to be considered, because I think people were looking at Netherlands as a team that could potentially go on and win it after that. You know, 3 wins out of 3, 9 points. They looked really, really impressive with scoring goals. And, you know, I know that it makes a big difference, and I think De Ligt has taken a lot of the blame for that performance. And that sort of big mistake that he made. But, you know, they really weren't on it from the sort of first half. Anyway, I don't think they were creating a barrel load of chances. You look back on their team squad, their team sheets, and you start to think, you know, were they good enough? Were they as good as what we were thinking they were after those first
games? Yeah, were they overperforming maybe? You know what I mean? Because someone like Memphis Depay has been levelled bags of abuse at him over the years now. Yeah. All of a sudden, he looks like the player he could have been, and maybe he was like flattering to deceive a little bit.
I mean, he still had Daley Blind in their back three.
Yeah.
So, you know, they didn't really have, like, sort of, you know, a great squad going into it. Obviously, they missed Virgil van Dijk, like, massively. Gigi Wijnaldum looked a good player as well. Like, I think, you know, obviously he's a great player for Liverpool. You know, I think he had a good tournament, and I think that Denzel Dumfries we mentioned earlier had a good tournament. So they did have a good few players, but just, you know, in these big international competitions, it don't matter, man. Czech Republic, fair play to them. Like,
yeah, they're well organised as well, man, the Czechs. Yeah.
And obviously, as you mentioned, Patrick Schick, has he got 4 goals now, Schick? You know, obviously that scream against Scotland as well. He looks like a really, really good player, man.
I know, yeah. If we end up coming against them, I'd be having an eye on him anyway. He's a little bit worrying. But on to the next one. And Portugal were defiant but ultimately outgunned, losing 1-0 to a Belgium that showcased a continuously dominant Romelu Lukaku and a resurgent Eden Hazard. Now, for me, we said with our tournament predictor, I think Belgium are going to go all the way. This wasn't the most exciting game. Disappointing to see Ronaldo and the lads go out, because yeah, I did actually like Portugal. I like watching their the way they play, their style, their counter-attacking, absolutely ruthless. But Belgium were just a better team, and there isn't really much else you can say about the game. Like,
but they have got to play Italy tonight, who weren't overly impressive against Austria.
Yeah.
Really, but, you know, Eden Hazard and Kevin De Bruyne's fitness concerns are going to be a massive worry for Martinez, yeah, because we saw how average Belgium looked for 45 minutes against the Danish. And then he could sort of, like, he's got the privilege to bring those two players on at half-time and completely change game. If those two aren't fit, Belgium are a completely different outfit.
Yeah, I agree. You know what I mean? So I haven't seen the team sheets for tonight, but yeah, I could absolutely agree with you.
So I think that, you know, that's going to be a really, really interesting game, 8 p.m. tonight. You'd have to say maybe one of those teams, they've got a very, very good chance of winning. I'd say Italy probably would they be the tournament favourites now, Italy?
I'm not sure. It changes from minute to minute, doesn't it? Yeah. The whole tournament favourites. So.
Obviously France getting knocked out. England still might be the tournament favourites, you know.
Oh, they started the thing as the tournament second favourites, so, didn't they? You can't, come on, man.
There must be with that side of the draw as well, because, you know, Belgium have got to play Italy, then they'll probably have to play Spain if they beat Switzerland. 5 o'clock kickoff. And obviously those Magic Monday games that we intonated towards earlier.
Yeah, so Spain led Croatia by 3-1 until the 85th minute and had looked composed, even if Croatia loosened their vice-like grip on the ball with sustained industry all over the park. Mislav Orsic gave the Croats a glimmer of hope with his goal with 5 minutes to go before Mario Pasalic clinched the equaliser at the very last. I was thinking the upset was in, but as extra time got underway, the Spaniards settled back into their possessive rhythm and the Croatian legs finally began to tire. Morata and Ozabayao scored in the 100th and 103rd minute respectively, bringing Spain through to the quarterfinals against the winner of the following game.
Yeah, I mean, you and I think you and Joe said you didn't like to watch Spain play.
I can't stand watching them play, honest to God. It bores me to tears. There's nothing else. I'm not saying they're not good. Obviously, yeah, they're an exceptional team. Keeping the ball like that, it signifies a philosophy rather than just a game-to-game tactical approach. But yeah, I could go to sleep during all of their games.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, hopefully there's more games like this, because if they're scoring goals and, you know, they are conceding goals as well, it's gonna make a really interesting contest to whoever they come up against. Like that game against Italy, for example, two contrasting styles, yeah. Really. One that sort of like to play a bit more direct, like to play on the front foot very defensively. Spain loved to keep the ball and try and, you know, sort of like have that positional play. And make sure there's triangles all over the pitch and sort of build through the thirds. It's going to be a real contrast in style. So, you know, if Morata keeps on, you know, I know there's been a few people that have sort of, you know, criticised him a lot, but I think great finish, great goal against Croatia with that. I think he scored the third, did he? He scored the third, and then we thought the game was over. And, you know, I just think he can grow from strength to strength, definitely. And another game that was 3-1, and ended up being 3-3 is the France-Switzerland game, which was even more incredible, I'd say.
It was an absolute pleasure to watch. I tuned in during the second half, being semi-certain of the result and also trying to shake off a bit of football fatigue that was descending on me, I've got to be honest. But when I saw Pogba's goal, the 30-yard curler into the very top corner that brought France 3-1 ahead, having been 1-0 down, I assumed the game was over. France began bombing forward. Koeman, Benzema, Pogba, Kante, all rushing forward like a blue tidal wave. Now, somewhat against the run of play, Switzerland's Harry Seferovic latched onto a cross in the 6-yard box to head home his second goal of the game. And with 10 minutes to go, it was all to play for. The Swiss needed every minute, but they would not be denied. Substitute Mario Gavranovic receiving a cutting pass from eventual man of the match, Granit Xhaka, skipping past Kimpembe and drove the ball past Lloris into the bottom left-hand corner. A fantastic finish to force extra time, where the struggle continued, but after a point, penalties were inevitable. And when the shootout arrived, it was one world-class strike after another until, unbelievably, Kylian Mbappe stepped up to take the country's fifth penalty. He hit it hard enough, but the ball was too central and the keeper committed early. Great save, shocking result. One of the best games of football I've seen, and I didn't even watch all of it.
Well, everyone that was watching the game must have thought when France went 3-1, it wasn't a case of like whether France were going to win the game. It was whether a case of whether they were going to take their foot off the gas.
Yeah.
Or that they were just, it could have been five. It could have been four, could have been five. And even at the end of the game, I think
Koeman hit the bar,
didn't he? Yeah. It was just an incredible match, so end to end. But it really shocked me how sort of tactically naive France were, you know, after they went 3-1 up.
I think they, like everyone else, thought this is done. The game's over. And then we spoke about it before, where how different a player Paul Pogba is when the pressure's on and when the pressure's off. When they were 3-1 up, and that goal, absolutely magnificent goal. But after they were 3-1 up, he was cutting half-volley passes, like just splitting the Switzerland defence. And he just looked like, oh my God, here's the world-class player that was winning leagues at Juventus that we should have been seeing at United this whole time. And then he was nowhere to be found when the Swiss started coming back.
The problem is, and I think there's been a lot of talk about this in the past and, you know, in current conversation as well. He's not a player that can work as part of a two midfielders. Like, he needs to be in a three midfield because he needs that protection of the players behind him. We spoke about this as well, I think. He needs to be able to have a look, a bit of a free roam playing forward, almost in the sort of Bruno Fernandes position at United. He needs to be playing that. And then you need, say, they call him McFred now, McTominay and Fred at United. Obviously, you need to get rid of them too, but at least one of them, because they need a better player playing in behind him. But I think someone like Kante, obviously Kante and Pogba still haven't lost in 30 games now for France or whatever, in terms of 90 minutes. But Kante needed somebody else, a bit more defensive-minded. And obviously, he started Adrien Rabiot at left-back when he had Lucas Hernandez, who plays for Bayern Munich, by the way.
Yeah, that was a bit of a weird one.
A left-back plays for Bayern Munich, and he started Adrien Rabiot there. If he would have started Adrien Rabiot alongside Kante, with Pogba a little bit further forward in an advanced position, Griezmann, Mbappe, Benzema as your three, and then put Lucas Hernandez in slot, because a natural left-back, slot him in at left-back, and then you can play whoever you want, Pavard at right-back, and then you got Kimpembe and Varane. There was no kind of like, all right, it made sense. It all tactically made sense. And then you haven't got this decision like where people are talking about Deschamps and whether he played the right system, whether he played the right personnel. They hadn't played a back five for 2 years or something. Why do that in a round of 16 game?
It's a bit weird, isn't it? That reeks of overconfidence to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Adrian Rabiot's ever played left back. I might be wrong. People might tell me now, watch him a lot at PSG or whatever. I think he's at PSG now. Like he does play left wing back sometimes, but it made no sense to me. He's a holding midfielder in my eyes.
But another key point as well, they just couldn't deal with Granit Xhaka. I'm not even saying that's because he's an Arsenal player. He was absolutely... He's never played a game like that any time I've ever seen him.
Yeah, man of match.
He looked like an absolute world beater.
And L'Equipe gave him a 6. How sour grapes is that? They gave him a 6 out of 10.
Does Etienne listen to this?
Oh, yeah. I think he does now and then.
Kimpembe is a worry. Absolutely. He is.
Yeah, man. He got that spot on. He got that absolutely spot on because Gavranovic made him look average. But yeah, it was a really shocking result. To me, cannot understand what he was thinking of with that formation. And he kept Rabiot there as well, pretty much the whole game.
Stubbornness, that is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Doubling down. He didn't want to admit his mistake.
He didn't particularly have a bad game, Rabiot, but it's not his natural position.
Yeah.
And when you had guys that play, you know, at teams like Bayern Munich to come in and play there, why not just play him, man? Why
it's
not?
Beyond, well, it's cost his team at the end of the day. I'm sure it might cost him his job at the end of the day as well. So, yeah, the final round of 16 games, Sweden were very unfortunate to lose 2-1 to Ukraine, England's quarterfinal opponents. And just before halftime, Emil Forsberg equalised Zinchenko's 27th minute opener and hit the post 2 or 3 times in addition to that.
Mm.
The game went to extra time and Marcus Danielsson was sent off in the 99th minute, not helping the Swedes' cause. It looked like they might hold on to see penalties, but Swedish hearts were shattered in the 121st minute as Artem Dovbyk snatched the latest possible winner. And as I said before, Ukraine-England in the quarterfinals. That's all the footy, isn't it? We did definitely need to give some of those games a bit of extra coverage, but we are pushing on that. And I'm very conscious that your wife needs to get back up here and start working like 15 minutes. So I'm going to just run through this combat sports roundup. Post-fight brawls at R3 Fighting Championship in Moscow and at BKFC 18 in Florida. Hector Lombard had just beaten Joe Riggs in the Bare Knuckle Organization's Cruiserweight title fight at the Hollywood Hard Rock Cafe when future potential opponent Lorenzo Hunt entered the ring after the bout for the usual in-ring stare-down shenanigans that we've all become so familiar with. But Lombard was still in fight mode and hit Hunt with a right and a left before being dragged away. It was clear from Hunt's reaction that Lombard had taken a hard left turn off the script, shall we say. But I will say, he approached Lombard from behind, appearing out of nowhere and towering over him to glare at him in this really provocative manner. I don't know if it deserved like getting a punch in the face, but he must have known like that was going to provoke some kind of reaction.
Yeah, he must.
It just seemed a bit naive, or maybe Lombard was just still absolutely raging after winning the title. Like, but at least that brief explosion was contained between the two of them. The brawl in Russia belonged in a Scunthorpe nightclub, to be honest with you. Fakhatbev Karimov versus Magomed Abdukhalikov. Oh, I nailed it first.
You've had loads of practice with these names, don't you? Like, you know.
So, they headlined the R3 fighting show, and oddly, I couldn't find who won the fight or whether the card was a professional or amateur MMA card. Regardless, after the main event, two members of the opposing fighters' teams were given microphones and allowed to have an argument for our viewing pleasure. From what resulted, and not for the first time, I got the impression that trash-talking with Russians is an ill-advised pursuit. It didn't take long for the first punch to be thrown and for half the crowd to enter the ring in full tribal warfare mode. Madness. But our Russian brethren took it a step further. Instead of dispersing the crowd and taking advantage of the brawl, perhaps using footage to promote future fights, organisers allowed the two men who started the whole thing to put gloves on and mouthguards in and fight there and then. Ushvadeth, brothers.
Mate, that sounds like an absolute fucking
It seems
war.
Fake. Yeah, and I wish I would have put the Twitter handle in where I found it, because you can't imagine that happening, can you? No, these two have started it. Maybe they should get suspended or fined or something. Now let them fight now, and we'll settle this like men. Like men, bro.
That's the way to resolve any sort of big argument.
Yeah,
really.
I know. But on the same night, and in the comparatively sterile world of the UFC, Ciryl Gane overcame Alexander Volkov in a very competitive fight in that main event to put himself squarely in heavyweight title contention. The fight went the full 5 rounds with powerful technical kickboxing on display from both men, the main difference being between them Gane's willingness to push forward into second and third phase attacks and his overall striking fluidity. With the UFC's heavyweight division so thin at the present, there's no reason Gane shouldn't get his shot if he wins another couple of fights, maybe less.
I would say, like, was this one really in any doubt? Like, I think you had a massive respect for this guy as well, coming into it undefeated. He looked like physically imposing, like lightning quick. and he really went to work after Volkov probably edged the first round, ensuring what I think it was 44% of his significant strikes landed in Volkov's head area. Round three was where Gann seemed to do the most of his damage, outstriking Volkov 41-23. And this was possibly what tilted the fight in Gann's favour, with the other rounds being a lot more competitive. It's incredible to see a bloke of this size move so quickly and so light on his feet.
It's unreal, isn't it?
I mean, you know, do you see a matchup on the horizon between either Curtis Blaydes or Derek Lewis before he gets that shot and Ngannou?
Well, since we've started working on the script for this episode, Cyril Gagne and Derek Lewis has been booked for the interim heavyweight title. Now, there's a little bit of contention about this because Ngannou, I think his manager or his agent has just got into a pissing contest with Dana White, basically. Ngannou is the champion. There's no reason for there to be an interim title fight right now other than this this power struggle going on behind the scenes. So that's a great fight, Cyril Gagne, Derek Lewis. Derek Lewis can end any fight with one shot, and he's peculiarly stubborn in terms of getting taken down. He just stands up with people on his back. You know, you see people technically working out things, he just gets up and then just starts punching. So the winner of this fight will go on to fight Ngannou sometime in the future if Dana White and his manager sorted out. Very exciting prospect. So over to the boxing, and Vasyl Lomachenko returned to his destructive best, putting a fearful beating on Masayoshi Nakatani to win inside 9 rounds. Nakatani looked like a strong puncher when he wasn't flinching and struggling to react to Loma's feints and darting movement. Many times during the fight, it seemed Loma vanished from view only to appear behind Nakatani, already swinging his left hand into the Japanese fighter's face. It was a mismatch in the end. Watching the final sequence made me feel like a bit of a masochist. And Loma's technique and instincts were so impressive, but with Nakatani jolting and swaying from every punch and battling his hardest to stay upright before succumbing, it was a lot to take in, really. And thankfully, there have been no reports of lasting damage to Nakatani. I think this version of Lomachenko has every chance in the world of avenging his loss to Teofimo Lopez and reclaiming those lightweight world championship belts.
Yeah, I think credit to another Japanese fighter, as we spoke about last week on the podcast, and how sort of, you know, the sort of boxing domain in that country has really sort of like progressed over the years. As you intonated, this was painful to watch, even when I was watching the highlights. It just, it was a struggle to watch. Lomachenko looks like a handful on the inside, to say the least. And the pressure he must put, like you wonder, as a competitor, when you're fighting against him as an opponent. Like, it's got to be so intense, like, fighting against him. It would be interesting to watch that Lopez fight back to see sort of where it was won or lost. I'm sure, like, if we had more time, you would be able to give me sort of, like, you know, a really extensive sort of analysis of why he lost that fight. But surely that's the fight everyone wants. That's the fight that we're going to hope to see in the sort of near future. Because, you know, how else can it work out? As Lopez got a fight booked, I think he's got one coming up, hasn't he?
It was George Kambosos Jr. who was meant to fight, but then he tested positive for COVID. But a lot of people are thinking this is just shenanigans, really. Because he's got a very complicated promotional situation between Triller and Bob Arum. Apparently he signed back with Bob Arum again. He's also got plans to move up to 140 because he's massive for that division.
So he's binned off that huge Triller contract that he was supposed to be getting.
There's a lot of grey area there. So yeah. I'm not sure exactly the finer details of that, but it's definitely messy, and I think he'll want to clear that up before he moves forward. And if he does move up to 140, he's going to be fighting this man, Gervonta Tank Davis, who has the most apt nickname in boxing. He earned his 24th stoppage in 25 wins with an 11th round KO of Mario Barrios.
That's pretty incredible, by the way, and it's 24 out of 25.
Especially at that weight class as well, and he's undersized at 140. So Barrios was patient and durable, but for a man who doesn't throw many punches, Davis makes them all count. I've spoken a lot about how undersized he is at 140, as I've just said, but he does use his size to his advantage, shielding with his forearms, slipping low, sometimes springing completely out of range before beginning his forward march again. Barrios' reach was a problem in the early rounds, but Davis soon negated that by leading with his left and looking to follow the jab back with hard, instantaneous counters, making Barrios a little bit hesitant to launch his attacks in the first place. All of his punches were like planned detonations at the base of the World Trade. I mean, at some kind of nondescript skyscraper. So I would love to see him fight Lomachenko down at 135, or Teofimo Lopez, or Devin Haney. Boxing politics will sabotage that dream for me, for the time being at least. But Tank Davis is one exciting fighter.
Yeah, I mean, fair play to both of them, because that looked like a serious fight to watch live, man. I reckon that was wicked. It looked like most people had Gervonta losing the at least for the first 6 rounds, I think, before he like knocked down Barrios. I think it was in the 7th for a couple of times. It looked like Barrios was extremely brave in the 11th, trying to battle on after that horrendous shot in the liver, which like made me feel sick.
Yeah, mate, that was a horrible just to look at, man.
Oh, it was nasty. I mean, is there a good reason why Ryan Garcia is apparently avoiding Tank? And do you think there's a viable fight in the near future if Garcia has a tune-up? Also, was there any reason Money Mayweather was wearing that many gold chains around his neck?
I think that was a pretty austere appearance from Mayweather by his usual standards.
Pretty low-key.
Yeah.
Looking pretty low-key.
He's trying not to stand out, standing at the side of the ring, giving instructions ahead of Davis's corner man. Oh, stop. He loves the limelight, doesn't he? But all these fights with Garcia, the aforementioned Lomachenko, Teofimo Lopez, it's all promotional stuff. Davis is with Premier Boxing Champions, PBC, Al Haymon, Floyd Mayweather, and their Showtime stable. I'm not sure where Ryan Garcia is, but I know Lomachenko and Teofimo Lopez are at Top Rank or in and out of Top Rank. Top Rank and PBC don't do business together. So that's always going to stop these kind of fights happening.
It's fucking crazy, man. I know we speak about it loads on the podcast, and every time you tell me this sort of shit, I'm always like, that is madness, man.
Unless it's one of like a Mayweather Pacquiao, Mike Tyson, Lennox Lewis. Those are the only two times I can think of, or HBO doesn't do boxing anymore, but it's the only time I can think of two mainstream boxing broadcasters working together because it's so much
fight, yeah.
And it's just, it's a rarity.
But you'd think the sort of adjudicator would be money, innit? Like, that's the one. Like,
well, there's just not enough to go around. That's why you have to wait for these mega fights. You think about Mayweather Pacquiao. I think Mayweather earned like 250. No, it's some mad money, like 200 million or something. And Pacquiao got 125 or somewhere around there.
That's what it took to make sure that this fight was brought together.
And that kind of money is not available for this fight. The audience isn't there. The
interaction probably isn't going to be there, is it?
Never be there. So one of them's going to have to leave their promoters and go to the other side for this to happen. At which time, the other guy will probably leave and then go to the opposite side. It happens all the time. It's so frustrating. But I'll just round off the boxing this week with the final results from the weekend. So Erickson Lubin halts Jason Rosario via 6-round TKO to bring himself back into contention against Jermell Charlo, who knocked him out 3.5 years ago, while also making Rosario's title win over Julian Williams look like an anomaly. Lubin was giving him a hard time in the third round, but had to stay composed when Rosario surged in the fourth. Ultimately, Lubin's body shots were the key. Rosario has the old Lewis Ritson deficiency. He just can't take him to the body, and you know, it's as simple as that. Any top fighter will exploit that from here on in. As for Lubin, he looked like a world beater when the fight was at his pace, but as soon as the action sped up, he did look vulnerable at times. He'll certainly have to cope with that a little bit better in a rematch with Charlo. And then for the previews for next week, this coming weekend, the only boxing match of note that will take place is between former super middleweight champion Gilberto Ramirez in his third fight at light heavyweight, and Sullivan Barrera, the Cuban stylist who suffered an unexpected points loss to Jesse Hart last time out. Ramirez is a southpaw with a 41-0 record and some decent names on his resume. Barrera has fought and lost to the very best in Andre Ward and Dimitri Bivol, but holds a win over current WBO champ Joe Smith Jr. This should be a decent one.
That's really the only kind of any combat sports of any import is that is going to be that fight this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, really. Shockingly, for the first time since we started this podcast 23 episodes ago, there are absolutely no MMA events at the big three this weekend. So no doubt the UFC are gearing up for McGregor Poirier 3 at UFC 264 on July 10th. That card's a banger. Gilbert Burns versus Wonderboy Thompson on the undercard. Sugar Sean O'Malley will also make his
fighting again. We seem to be talking about him every week.
I know, yeah. We're helping the hype train. God, he should give us a percentage, man. As will O'Malley's antithesis and one of my personal favourites, Ryan Hall, who's had a terrible run of injuries and difficulty getting fights since winning season 22 of The Ultimate Fighter. Bellator are back on July 16th with their 262 event, while ONE Championship will return sooner on the 9th with their 139 card. And that is everything.
So we're going to have, obviously we're going to have a lot more football chat next week because that's still Euros. It's going to be the quarterfinals reviews from this week, this weekend. Obviously two games tonight, two games tomorrow, and then we're going to have the sort of the semi-final be on Wednesday. So we might even have the semi-final to talk about if England get there. So
yeah,
we could have two England games to chat about next week. Obviously we're not going to have much in the world of combat sports to talk about, but we'll try and work some in next week, some a little bit different. We've had a few little tidbits that we've wanted to sort of talk about for a while now. There's a few things that have been on sort of previous scripts that maybe we might be able to work in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think next week, with that being the 10th is on the Saturday, so my main preview will just be about McGregor Poirier, really.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot to talk about there. So
They're already starting the back and forth already, aren't they, this weekend? Yeah.
And apparently, from Conor McGregor's Instagram, someone's pointed out a little blemish on his elbow that might indicate that he's got a staph infection, which is something that severely compromises your immune system in training. It's really prevalent in jiu-jitsu gyms. Now, I've had staph infection before, and it knocks you on your ass.
What eagle-eyed, like, hawk is...
Someone whose Twitter handle is Kamayev Smash, so you know what side of the water he's on, man. Absolutely. But yeah, a lot of stuff to talk about. Not just the fight itself, but the promotion, the build-up, the excitement. Can he do it again? Can he come back? Can Magic Mac do it one more time? Really looking forward to it.
All right, so wicked, man. Enjoyed it. Obviously, we're going to watch the England game tomorrow at Joe's 30th. So we're going to be having a few beers watching that. We should do a live a live podcast to watch the game.
The noise would be too much of an issue. It's his 30th birthday party.
Also, so. I'll be sat like probably not watching it, innit?
No. Never say no, mate.
All right, thanks for watching. Check us out on the usual social media channels. Make sure you listen to all our previous episodes if you get a chance. And we will see you next week. And I'll see you next week.
Till next time.